Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. Author, Robert D. Kaplan. Summary, we are entering a new era of global cataclysm in which the world faces a deadly mix of war, climate change, great power rivalry, rapid technological advancement, the end of both monarchy and empire, and countless other dangers. In Wasteland, Robert D. Kaplan, geopolitical expert and author of more than 20 books on world affairs, incisively explains how we got here and where we are going. Kaplan makes a novel argument that the current geopolitical landscape must be considered alongside contemporary social phenomena such as urbanization and digital news media, grounding his ideas in foundational modern works of philosophy, politics, and literature, including the poem from which the title is borrowed, and celebrating a canon of traditionally conservative thinkers, including Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Jean Kirkpatrick, and many others. As in many of his books, Kaplan looks to history and literature to inform the present, drawing particular comparisons between today's challenges and the Weimar Republic, the post-World War I democratic German government that fell to Nazism in the 1930s. Just as in Weimar, which faced myriad crises inextricably bound up with global systems, the singular dilemmas of the 21st century pandemic disease, recession, mass migration, the destabilizing effects of large-scale democracy and great power conflicts, and the intimate bonds created by technology mean that every disaster in one country has the potential to become a global crisis, too. According to Kaplan, the solutions lie in prioritizing order in governing systems, arguing that stability and historic liberalism rather than mass democracy per se will save global populations from an anarchic future. Chapter 1, Weimar Goes Global. Premonitions can be precious. They offer an uncanny, decipherable warning about something or other, especially if the person having them is at the right place at the right time. Consider the Anglo-American Christopher Isherwood and the German Alfred Döblin, novelists who each wrote about Berlin in the 1920s and early 1930s. In the guise of fiction, a writer can more easily tell the truth, hiding behind his characters and other forms of make-believe. Their Berlin is a fantastic, neurotic nightmare. Isherwood, in Goodbye to Berlin, describes an edgy, decadent demi-monde, marked by wholesale perversion and end-of-the-world partying, flaky characters on unending sprees of drinking and carousing all set against the backdrop of a bankrupt middle class living amid second-hand furniture in shabby, leaking buildings plastered with hammers and sickles and swastikas. He zooms in on a down-at-heel innkeeper, cleaning chamber pots, battered by the Great War and inflation. There are bank closures, sullen crowds, and the eerie pageant of burying social democracy amid black banners of one extremist group or the other. Berlin is a skeleton which aches in the cold, Isherwood writes. This town is sick with Jews. Turn over any stone, and a couple of them will crawl out. They're poisoning the very water we drink, exclaims one of his characters. 1. Isherwood lived in Berlin from 1929 to 1933, the year Adolf Hitler came to power, so Goodbye to Berlin, as prescient as the author's initial experiences were, was helped a bit by hindsight. Döblin's Berlin Alexanderplatz was published in the fall of 1929, when people had still not given up on the Weimar constitutional experiment and the future did not seem hopeless. But only a few weeks after the book's publication, the stock market crashed on Wall Street, sending tremors all over Europe and especially Germany. Berlin Alexanderplatz contains a stunning premonition not just of chaos but of something far worse and murderous that succeeds it, and also of the general instability of cities in the 20th and 21st centuries, including those in the developing world. Berlin, in Döblin's rendering, is Sodom on the eve of its destruction. Döblin's book is hard to read, almost plotless. It is filled with cluttered rhythms and long asides, and its lowdown, scummy characters go from one petty disaster to another. But the book is also full of sound and streetwise wisdom. Listen. On Alexanderplatz they're tearing up the road for the underground railway. People are made to walk on duckboards. The trams cross the square and head up Alexander and Munzstrasse to get to Rosenthaler Tor. In the streets, there's one house after another. They are full of people, from cellar to attic. The tenancy protection law isn't worth the paper it's written on. Rents are going up all the time. The middle class are finding themselves out on the street, bailiffs and debt collectors are making hay. The protagonist, Franz Biberkopf, an ex-con, sells far-right-wing newspapers on the street. Not that he's got anything against the Jews, but he is a supporter of order, says the narrator. The book concludes with a vision of people, arms linked, marching into war, now that the old world is doomed. Doom is the word that immediately comes to mind when thinking about the Weimar Republic. Weimar is a candy-coated horror tale, a cradle of modernity that gave birth to fascism and totalitarianism. Weimar signifies an artistically and intellectually vibrant period defined by the novels of Thomas Mann and Hermann Hesse, the expressionist poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke, the atonal music of Arnold Schoenberg, the design and architectural experimentation of the Bauhaus, a period replete with so much social and cultural experimentation, yet packed with nasty racial and religious tensions, to say nothing of inflation and depression, all leading, without skipping a beat, to Hitler. Yes, we all know how it ends. But its participants, caught in freeze frame in the act of everything that they were doing, could have no idea what was in store for them. Will we be any the wiser? I ask because Weimar now beckons us. But not at all in the way we think. We think about Weimar only in terms of the weakening of American democracy. While we should really think about it in terms of the world. At the moment, we rush headlong into a soulless and gleaming future, our lives grimly routinized and yet full of overwhelming possibilities, determined by gadgetry that we cannot do without. Technology has made us both masters and victims to a previously unimaginable degree. We believe we can defy gravity, yet we are weighed down by a mountain of worries that arrive instantly in our devices. This is a very claustrophobic and intimate world, yet also limitless. We may be connected with friends and relations around the globe, but just as often the people in the house or apartment next to ours might as well be in another universe. This alienation carries over from our neighborhoods to our politics. Politics has rarely before been played out on such an intense, globe-spanning, and consequential level, even as electronic communications have made it abstract and therefore more extreme, creating vast political distances between even our closest neighbors. Yet, technology has also contracted our world, erasing the distance across oceans and between continents. We directly experience the burgeoning of new cities defined by technology and glittering financial centers, which vaguely look the same no matter the hemisphere or latitude where they are located. The future is here, and wherever we are stuck in traffic. We are building a truly global civilization that connects us all, and that is the challenge. Precisely because this global civilization is still in the act of becoming, and has not yet arrived, and will not arrive for some time, there is this phenomenon of both intimacy and distance between the various parts of the globe. True globalization is still an illusion until technology and world governance advance a few more orders of magnitude. Yet we dramatically affect each other and depend upon each other, so that we all inhabit the same, highly unstable global system. It is like in Sartre's play No Exit, in which the three characters are locked in a small room and torment each other. With no mirrors on the walls, they only know themselves by the gaze of the others upon them. Indeed, we are liberated and oppressed by connectedness, with the media increasingly directing governments rather than the other way around. Russia and America, China and America, Russia and China, to say nothing of the mid-level and smaller powers, are all, because of their tense standoffs and the way that technology continues to contract the earth, running a strange simulation of the Weimar Republic, that weak and wobbly political organism that governed Germany for 15 years from the ashes of World War I to the ascension of Adolf Hitler. The entire world is one big Weimar now, connected enough for one part to mortally influence the other parts, yet not connected enough to be politically coherent. Like the various parts of the Weimar Republic, we find ourselves in an exceedingly fragile phase of technological and political transition. I see no Hitler in our midst, or even a totalitarian world state. But don't assume that the next phase of history will provide any relief to the present one. It is in the spirit of caution that I raise the subject of Weimar. Analogies can be futile, I know, since no thing is exactly like another. Analogies can lead us down a perilous path. Yet they are often the only way to communicate and explain. While on the one hand an analogy is an imperfect distortion, on the other hand it can create a new awareness, another way to see the world. It is only through an analogy that I can begin to describe the depth of our global crisis. We have to be able to consider that literally anything can happen to us. This is the usefulness of Weimar. What, exactly, was Weimar? The great German historian Golo Mann, son of the Nobel laureate in literature Thomas Mann, called Weimar a sprawling and unwieldy empire without an emperor. World War I, which lasted for long years, and which ordinary Germans though originally would be a triumph, ended in defeat, 1.75 million German military deaths, and almost a half million German civilian deaths. The country was shattered, the royal imperial governing structure had collapsed, and Germany was on the verge of social chaos. It was in that context that leading German politicians and lawyers, meeting in the Thuringian town of Weimar, devised a new constitutional arrangement that sought to avoid the autocratic tendencies of the Kaiser and Bismarck before him. But the new arrangement was just too weak to withstand the pressures of what was to come. There was no night watchman to keep the peace between its constituent parts. The federal states, or Länder, legislated through the Reichsrat, or upper house of parliament, retaining all rights not explicitly transferred to the central government. The nation as a whole elected the head of state, or Reich president. The president then appointed the chancellor, who with his cabinet ran the government at the behest of the Reichstag, the lower house, which was elected by the people. Two-thirds of Germany was still called Prussia, and was governed under different rules than the Länder. As for Bavaria, which, like Prussia, was a veritable state within a state, there was constant talk of separation from the Reich. If all this seems like a far more complicated version of the US Constitution with its separation of powers, it was and made more unwieldy by economic and social anarchy. There was catastrophic inflation during the early Weimar years and catastrophic depression toward the end, a result of a very difficult post-war economy, made worse by reparations demanded by the Treaty of Versailles, and by world economic dislocations. Germany during the Weimar period from 1918 to 1933 was a vast and barely united world unto itself, where the rules of order scarcely applied. It was less a government than a system of belligerent and far-flung competing parts, given the regional differences of a sprawling and, in historical terms, recently united Germany. Again, this is like our world today, with its great cultural and even civilizational differences, yet on another level becoming increasingly united at the same time. Weimar's normal state was crisis, writes the late Stanford historian of Germany Gordon A. Craig. 5. In that sense, Weimar was like our planet now, intimately connected, so as to have crises that cut across oceans, whether it be COVID-19, a global recession, great power conflicts, or unprecedented climate change, things that we can all argue and talk about in the same conversation. To recall Weimar is to emphasize and admit the growing interdependencies of our own world, and to accept responsibility for them. So rather than interrelated German states, so that a crisis in one becomes a crisis in all countries are now connected in ways in which a crisis for one can contain a domino effect that becomes almost universal. The Weimar phenomenon, therefore, becomes one of scale. Roaming the cities and towns of Germany in the early Weimar years were the Free Corps, rowdy and ill-disciplined young militiamen unwilling to disband after World War I for fear of suffering the deprivations of civilian life. They would provide the recruiting base for the first Nazi stormtroopers. In fact, by the mid-1920s all the major political parties, the Communists, the Social Democrats, and so forth, had their own private little armies. Governments within Greater Germany were constantly in the process of collapsing and regrouping with slightly different cabinets. It was one long cabinet crisis where everything always seemed to be at stake. Central authority exhausted itself just trying to preserve order, and in the final Weimar years, all anyone could talk about in Germany was daily politics. It was truly a permanent crisis, with one breathless series of headlines following another. The public and politicians both were caught up in the moment, in all of its intensity, unable to concentrate on what might come next because the present was so overwhelming. Everyone was hanging on for dear life, unaware of where they were going. Golo Mann writes, "Divided and alienated from itself, led by weak or reluctant politicians, the nation was confronted by problems the hopeless confusion of which would have daunted a Bismarck VI again. This is a rough metaphor for our time, in a world beset by multiple crises, when one takes into account not only the West but all the turbulent reaches of Eurasia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Latin America. The former Third World may be no more unstable now than it used to be, and in many cases it is more developed, but globalization has rendered it much more deeply entwined with our own destinies. Outrages were manifold. Famously there was the Freikorps murder in 1922 of the very able Foreign Minister Walther Rathenau, a philosopher, intellectual, and liberal Jewish politician. Rathenau had negotiated the Treaty of Rapallo, which allowed Germany to trade more with Soviet Russia at a time when Germany was under severe economic restrictions imposed by the Treaty of Versailles. Gunmen lobbed grenades and opened fire on him at close range. The next year, in 1923, came Hitler's failed Beer Hall Putsch, an attempted coup d'état that began at the Bürgerbrau Keller, a beer hall in Munich. The event would have a comic opera aspect to it if it hadn't been so ugly, demonstrative of all the thuggery, rowdiness, incipient anarchy, and general incompetence of the politics of the era. The Beer Hall Putsch was an example of how law and order could begin to disintegrate even in an advanced country. It started when Bavarian leaders were in a rage to establish a right-wing, nationalist regime in Berlin and met at the Bürgerbrau Keller to plan strategy. Rightist elements in Munich, the capital of Bavaria, had long been obsessed with decadent and cosmopolitan Berlin, so well described by Isherwood and Döblin, and its weak, defeatist, democratic governments. But Hitler and his Nazis, supported by other paramilitary groups, feared those same nationalist politicians as potential rivals. Hitler entered the beer hall, backed by dozens of uniformed street fighters armed with knives and blackjacks, fired his pistol in the air, and while surrounded by bodyguards addressed the crowd and loudly bullied its leaders. Yet this far-right uprising, now led by Hitler, began to collapse when it failed to secure key buildings in the city, and it fell into general disorganization, which featured diversions such as haphazard, armed attacks against Jews and Jewish stores in Munich. But once out of Hitler's sight, the Bavarian nationalists, whom he and his armed goons had bullied, denounced his coup. In a last-ditch effort to rally support, Hitler led 2,000 Nazis in a thunderous and riotous march to a local monument, where Munich police bloodily put down the uprising. Hitler, wounded and almost killed in the melee a bullet came within a foot of him, was sentenced to 5 years in prison but was released after 8 months in a minimum security facility, where he was allowed to write Mein Kampf. 7. Thereafter Hitler vowed to work within the democratic system to achieve power ostensibly, that is which is exactly what would happen a decade later. Democracy, when weak and unstable, and conducted in a context of tottering institutions, is no guarantee against tyranny. The world is big and varied and at various stages of political development, and the Beer Hall Putsch holds lessons for our time, lessons about how fragile governmental authority is in many parts of the world and, consequently, how little it takes to undermine them, leading to crises that cross borders. It wasn't all doom and gloom, though. The years of the mid and late 1920s that were associated with Gustav Stresemann, a liberal realist politician, by all accounts brilliant, who served as both chancellor and foreign minister, constituted a time of economic growth, cultural blossoming, and political compromises and reconciliations. There was a distinct sense for a while that things were getting better and that Germany was finally emerging out of post-war chaos. Stresemann's diplomacy virtually removed the restrictions placed upon German sovereignty by the Versailles Peace Treaty after Germany's defeat in World War I, except for the question of armaments. There was another bout of optimism, at least momentarily, when the fiscal conservative Heinrich Brüning emerged in early 1930 to lead a fairly nonpartisan cabinet of national emergency. However, Brüning's gifts as a technocrat were not matched by his political instincts. He lacked the ability to compromise and maneuver at a time when he was trying to force tough economic choices and hardships, including wage cuts and a tightening of credit, upon the population and the political parties. Had Brüning been a Bismarck, he might, despite the daunting circumstances, have been able to pull this off, writes historian Gordon Craig, by presenting his policy demands as a matter of principle associated with his person. Brüning's government struggled on until it collapsed in 1932. This cabinet of technocrats had been eaten away by extremist forces in the streets, Nazis and communists both. It may have been the last real chance the Weimar Republic had to right itself. History is Shakespearean as well as geopolitical, a matter of contingencies, and if Brüning had not had the personal limitations that he did, the history of the 20th century might have been vastly different. The more abject the disorder, often the more extreme the tyranny to follow, and that brings us to Weimar's last chapter. Weimar's House of Cards collapsed in 1932 under its next-to-last chancellor, Franz von Papen, a rightist authoritarian and amateur horseman without a political base, a man whom Golo-Mann describes irresponsible, and pitifully superficial. Von Papen's government just couldn't get anything done and didn't last the year. Indeed, at this point there was endless cabinet jockeying but no real governance. Yet even after von Papen left office, he remained a close advisor to President Paul von Hindenburg. When asked why Hindenburg, bowing to the advice of von Papen and a few others, had named Hitler as Chancellor on January 30, 1933, von Papen replied, "You are wrong, we have only hired him. We have framed him in," added one of von Papen's friends about Hitler, believing that he could easily be contained in that role. Golo, man asks what is the meaning of human existence when such a lightweight as von Papen could at a key juncture determine the course of world history. 9 Again, there are large, overwhelming forces of geography, culture, and economics, and there are also contingencies based on pivotal personalities. History blends the two. Only hours after Hitler had been appointed chancellor, Nazi troopers, brown shirts and black shirts both, paraded in high boots in their tens of thousands, carrying torches, banging on drums, through the streets of Berlin, singing warlike songs. Degree before 2 months had passed, all traces of democracy had been extinguished and the Weimar Republic was but a distant memory. It had left a vacuity so great that literally anything could follow in its wake. Yes, Weimar had constituted a vacuum eventually filled by Nazi totalitarianism. But our world today must have a different destiny. Like Weimar, it is an interconnected system of states in which no one really rules. But world geography is still a factor. The Earth is vast enough so that no individual political force can really dominate it, as happened at the end of Weimar, a loose-limbed republic that covered only the geographical center of Europe. So rather than risk the rise of another Hitler, we are forced to wallow in one sort of emergency or another without pause, as crises seep and ricochet across the globe. Weimar is now a permanent condition for us, as we are connected enough by technology to affect each other intimately without having the possibility of true global governance. And that is not the worst outcome since, had Hitler not arrived, Weimar might ultimately have righted itself. There are quite a few Weimar democracies in the developing world, and quite a few of them may yet succeed. The key is to make constructive use of our fears about Weimar, so as to be wary about the future without giving in to fate. Winston Churchill put the problem of Weimar in broad perspective. Near the end of World War II, after 50 million deaths, Churchill reflected that if the Allies at the peace table at Versailles had not imagined that the sweeping away of long-established dynasties was a form of progress, and if they had allowed a Hohenzollern, a Wittelsbach, and a Habsburg to return to their thrones, there would have been no Hitler, who had come to power in a complete vacuum of generational order. The Hohenzollerns had ruled Germany, including Prussia. The Wittelsbachs had ruled Munich and Bavaria, and the Habsburgs had ruled Austria-Hungary eastward almost to the Black Sea. Those dynasties were reactionary and lazily corrupt. But their rules, which had lasted for centuries, bore the mark of stability and legitimacy. And because they were inherently legitimate, their cruelties born of autocratic tendencies could remain within acceptable bounds. They were dictatorial without being totalitarian. That is, they generally protected minorities and allowed a political breathing space for opposing views. But because they were all on the losing side in World War I, and headed political systems that had been in decline even before the war, these monarchical and imperial orders were dashed into oblivion at the 1919 Paris Peace Treaty. The result, in a phrase, was the Beer Hall Putsch and events like it, which originated from an utter vacuum of legitimate political authority, that allowed thugs and bullies to run riot, invading the political space. Churchill might have made the same argument concerning the Romanovs and the Ottomans. Lying on the eastern and southeastern fringes of Europe, these royal houses and empires were more benighted than those of their imperial cousins in the cultural heart of the continent. But what was to follow them would generally be worse. Indeed, the 20th century in Europe, Russia, and the Greater Middle East was determined by the collapse of long-standing dynastic empires in the early decades, and world war, mass murder, state-inflicted famine, and geopolitical upheaval in later decades. The dynasties discarded after World War I in Central Europe represented the old world of imperialism, which had held sway for centuries and millennia, and within which were cosmopolitan societies of different ethnicities and religions that got along tolerably well considering everything, ruled as they were by a common sovereign. Now compare that to what was to come afterward, which were often virulent modern states and unstable, uni-ethnic democracies that often identified with the dominant ethnic or religious group against the others, setting the stage for World War II, followed by the Cold War, and after that, wars in the Middle East and Ukraine involving regimes that had emerged from a vacuum of royal authority. Churchill saw all of this because he was a man of empire, an Edwardian-era reactionary who had experienced colonial wars in Africa firsthand, and, because of his pride in Britannia, was willing to fight Hitler early on, before many other members of the British establishment had even recognized Nazi Germany as a threat. Churchill's imperialism was inseparable from his anti-Nazism, as inconvenient as that realization may be. Churchill identified Hitler, much as the young Henry Kissinger did by way of an analogy with Napoleon, as a revolutionary chieftain, threatening World Order II in both Churchill's and Kissinger's minds. World order may not be altogether fair or compassionate even, but it does constitute the foremost political legitimacy to be had in the secular realm of human affairs. In truth, order must come before freedom, because without order there is no freedom for anyone. The Weimar Republic, because it lacked the requisite order, ultimately became a threat to freedom, despite the explosion of the arts that it fostered. Human nature being what it is, order must remain the paramount political virtue. Without it there is no one, as Hobbes says, to adjudicate right from wrong, to separate the guilty from the innocent, so not only is there no freedom but no justice. These are the central realizations of classical conservatives, who prefer stability to illusions of progress, from which all other realizations emanate. Obviously, individual freedom involves a certain amount of messy disorder, especially in a mass democracy like that of the United States. But that is not what I am talking about. I am talking about a secure, stable, and orderly political system where the rules are adhered to. The late Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington explained that what made America great was less its ideals than its institutions, including the separation of powers between executive, legislative, and judicial branches, and between the federal, state, and local authorities. The 2017-21 presidency of Donald Trump tested those institutions, but they nevertheless held firm. Though Weimar boasted an abundance of artistic and cultural freedom, its fundamental absence of basic political and institutional order made Hitler possible, through the machinations of Von Papen and a few others equally in over their heads, and operating in a complete vacuum of restraint. In the early 1920s, Hitler had tried to violently overthrow a democratic government but served very little jail time as a consequence. That was the mark of a weak system, riven with backroom deals and compromises, that didn't believe in itself. Weimar's democracy was ultimately no safeguard against Hitler, although Hohenzollern and Wittelsbach monarchs, even constitutional ones with little real power in Berlin and Munich, might well have been up to the task had they remained in place after World War I. That is because the very age-old tradition of those monarchies would have helped stabilize their governing systems. It would have made the politicians more serious, and made them less afraid, since they would have been holding up something estimable and mystical even that had stood the test of time. Again, Churchill was on target with his defense of the royal families of Central Europe, despite the fact that they were implicated in a disastrous world war that had killed millions. Yes, history shows us no easy path forward. Democracy has worked in the West and a few other places for several hundred years, whereas the moral example of kings and queens relying, as the 19th century British journalist Walter Bagehot implied, on their aesthetic, emotional, and numinous power has stabilized vast portions of the earth for millennia. Thus, to declare that an age of democracy across the globe is now upon us, with new states having replaced old empires, may not augur as well as we think. Always remember that the existing figurehead monarchies of Great Britain, Spain, and Northern Europe, especially Scandinavia, continue to play a vital role in the relatively boring stability of those countries' politics. The institution of monarchy, shorn of its absolute power, writes the mid-2th century American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, possesses virtues that arise from the continuing will and unity of a nation as distinguished from the momentary will, embodied in specific governments. 3. We take those royal houses for granted only because their presence is assured. Much of the rest of the world is not so lucky. Because the world in general has lost its kings and empires, freedom itself has made the possibilities of upheaval all the more real. That is particularly true in places such as Russia, China, and the Middle East, where monarchical rule with its inherent legitimacy has been replaced by modernizing dictatorships that have to be doubly aggressive and repressive in order to justify their hold on power. As for the advent of democratic states in other parts of the world, the responsibility for restraint and wise governance is now theirs like never before in their own histories. There is no longer any sovereign to appeal to. The reason why the 20th and early 21st centuries have been so bloody is because the stabilizing force of monarchy in Central Europe, Russia, the Middle East, and other places is, in deep historical terms, suddenly gone. We believe we have morally progressed in our values, with an unprecedented emphasis on such things as human rights and the environment, but this says little about the stability of a global system beset by clashing interests, fed by the aggression of modernizing dictatorships in places like Russia and China. And this global system is tightly wound together as never before, which brings us back to the analogy with Weimar. The last years and months of Weimar intimately recall the Russian Revolution of 1917, when Russia descended into utter anarchy following the abdication of the Tsar, paving the way for the Bolshevik coup 8 months later. The opposite of anarchy is hierarchy, from which order derives. And the removal of the Tsar undermined the only real hierarchy that existed in Russia. In this sense, the Russian Revolution is more than just a corollary to the finale of the Weimar Republic. It is a panoramic amplification of it, a master key to the whole experience and consequences of political disorder. And the most effective way to explore it is through the books of one man, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Thus, he deserves a thorough description. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was born in 1918, a year after the Russian Revolution. He served in the Red Army as an artillery officer against the Germans in World War II, and because of a letter he wrote toward the end of his military service criticizing Stalin, he then served 8 years of forced labor in the Gulag in Kazakhstan. Yet perhaps the most important period of his life was spent outside the tiny village of Cavendish, Vermont, where during 19 years of solitude he wrote several of the massive books comprising the Red Wheel series, a virtual minute-by-minute history of the Russian Revolution. Think of it, having been exiled from the Soviet Union for exposing its vast crimes against humanity in earlier books, and having won the Nobel Prize in Literature for that endeavor, Solzhenitsyn turned his back on the lionization that might have awaited him in certain literary quarters of New York and cultural capitals of Europe, and instead in 1975 settled his family in the backwoods of Vermont, in a cold and desolate landscape whose winters approximate Russia's, and simply wrote. Cavendish is particularly remote, with a general store selling guns and ammo. It felt a world apart from the ski resorts of the other, more cosmopolitan Vermont associated with Bernie Sanders. Generally avoiding visitors for the next two decades, Solzhenitsyn churned out about a half dozen books, averaging roughly 750 pages each, that together tell the story of the anarchy of the Russian Revolution and its antecedents, and with it a warning for the 21st century. This act of sheer energy, concentration, self-discipline, and renunciation of the conventional worldly pleasures and satisfactions bestowed even by a skeptical literary elite was in the spirit of Russia's own Eastern monasticism. It made Solzhenitsyn, a conservative traditionalist who died in 2008, not merely a great man of literature, but one of the great men of the 20th century. The Red Wheel series consists of discrete knots, or nodes as Solzhenitsyn later preferred to call them, August 1914, November 1916, and thus far, as I write, three fat volumes of March 1917. More volumes are to come as Marion Swartz's work on the translation continues. Except for the first volume, August 1914, the rest were substantially written in self-imposed exile in Vermont, before Solzhenitsyn's return to Russia following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Again, it is in the guise of fiction where a writer can more accurately tell the truth. These novels are history told in the spirit of the present tense. Solzhenitsyn seems to leave nothing out, not even the tedium of a deranged marathon of sleepless nights in the palaces of Petrograd and elsewhere, fueled by tea and alcohol. He relives and recreates how it all happened in Russia in the second decade of the 20th century, and he does not allow this pivot of world events to be bastardized by the clever hindsight of historians and the comfortable value judgments of our own time. For his difficult and unappealing message is meant for the West as well as for his fellow Russians. Solzhenitsyn demonstrates rather than merely states the need for order above all else. Order in pre-revolutionary Russia constituted a medieval totality, represented by the absolutism of the Romanov dynasty. Tsar Nicholas II was stupid, indecisive, and self-destructive. He had no judgment. But as much as Nicholas retreated into a reactionary past even as Russian society was experiencing the painful birth pangs of modernization, there could simply be no Russia without the monarchy. Alas, Nicholas was understandably hated as much as his family was necessary. This is the signal tragedy that Solzhenitsyn captures in these novels. I will get to the Tsar later on in more detail. But I want to start with Solzhenitsyn's larger points, and then paint the broader picture of pre-revolutionary Russia in World War I and the subsequent political upheaval there, perhaps the greatest of the 20th century, that reverberates to this day and is central to my overall thesis of Weimar. It is a conceit of the modern world, and particularly of the West, Solzhenitsyn suggests, that history is governed by reason. Reason is like an axe to the living, growing tree of history, with its convoluted branches, each cell and molecule emerging as a matter of sheer contingency, one building upon the next so that great events arise from innumerable plots and threads. Solzhenitsyn in these books provides a treatise on unreason and the subsequent creation of the modern world in the 20th century, in which the axe of reason, as he puts it, is rare, and when it does fall sometimes produces absolute terror. The Russian Revolution, like Hitler's rise, turns out to be the most contingent of events, which begins with a complex and bungled war and ends with a shaky Bolshevik coup that sets in motion a death virtually unrivaled in history that would kill tens of millions. And furthermore, none of this might have happened had Russia's resolutely effective and politically moderate Prime Minister, Peter Stolypin, a real force for stability and human agency, not been assassinated in September 1911 at the Kiev Opera House. It was Stolypin's death that would end any hope for decent governance emanating from Nicholas's court. When things are too clear, they are no longer interesting, says one of the author's characters. Solzhenitsyn knows that a bundle of passions can decide a seemingly clear-cut and rational action, to say nothing of the most consequential decisions that can be decided by a momentary mood, for example, the assassin's decision to go through with his killing of Stolypin. Hindsight is lazy in this regard, Solzhenitsyn intimates, since it reduces complexity to a counterfeit clarity. He replaces hindsight with a multitude of characters thinking and acting in the moment, so that at the beginning of World War I, the clock of fate was suspended over the whole of East Prussia, and its six-mile-long pendulum was ticking audibly as it swung from the German to the Russian side and back again, for indeed, the life and death of whole battalions of men, as the author ably demonstrates, can be affected by a misplaced pencil movement on a general's dimly lit field map. Prediction is impossible. It is only through coming to terms with the past and vividly realizing the present that we can have premonitions about the future. Solzhenitsyn's dissection of the Russian defeat at the Battle of Tannenberg, which occupies much of the action of August 1914, should be studied at every military war college. Without that failure, there might well have been no Romanov abdication, no Lenin, and thus no 20th century as we know it. As in both Weimar Germany and our interconnected world today, Russia in those years was so institutionally fragile that any significant event could turn it off course. The ability of the Ukraine war to affect the trajectory of 21st century geopolitics in ways only now being perceived becomes more palpable when reading Solzhenitsyn's analysis of the Battle of Tannenberg, which covers hundreds of pages and is panoramic, immersive, and masterly, the equivalent in typewriter ink of Peter Brueghel the Elder's painting Fight Between Carnival and Lent. As with any writer of great epics, Solzhenitsyn knows many disparate things: the technicalities of artillery formations and field maneuvers, the mental process by which semi-starving, overextended, and ill-led soldiers become looters, how small changes in terrain affect forced marches, as well as the placement of the stars in the night sky and the names of many Orthodox saints. In Europe on the eve of World War I, order itself, which had lasted more or less a century since the conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars, was completely accepted. In other words, too few were thinking tragically in order to avoid tragedy. They didn't realize that pessimism can be constructive and help states to avoid catastrophe. They took their good fortune for granted, and assumed it was a permanent condition. War between Russia and Germany begins in a whirlpool of emotion on Solzhenitsyn's pages. Elation was general, especially in Moscow and Petrograd. After all, this was one war you could not reject. Historic obligations to Slavic brothers in Serbia were sacred. A European war cannot be a prolonged conflict. Of course, the popular naivete preceding World War I is an old story that is the stuff of many books. But Solzhenitsyn goes on to illuminate in his saga how the same innocence will carry through the entire revolutionary process in Russia, in which words like war and revolution mean very different things to a people whose frame of reference extended only to the end of the 19th century. Thus they had no conception of how history could wildly swerve in a new technological age. They would not know that the new military conflict would be nothing like the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71, or that the revolution to come would yield nothing like the French Revolution of 1789, which even with its reign of terror was altogether benign compared to what was in store for Russia. People sleepwalked backward into the horrors of the 20th century, blindly slashed by its revolving blades. We might pause to learn a lesson from this. Because the past up to this point in time is all we know, we must always exercise a monumental level of caution in order to protect our civilization from tipping over into a heretofore unimagined disorder. Solzhenitsyn doesn't tell us any of this, he illustrates it through dozens of fully realized characters. World War I in Solzhenitsyn's rendering comes to define the horrors of modernism itself with its rejection of the past, as we leave behind traditional societies with their neat and orderly boundaries and enter a borderless world. Here scale itself becomes a generator of crises, exactly as in our world today. Such a borderless realm is defined by juxtapositions. World War I on the Eastern Front begins with the uneasy specter of the blunt fact of national culture conjuring itself up. Solzhenitsyn concentrates on the most obvious, deterministic aspects of the ground truth reality that our policy and intellectual elites sometimes want to avoid. To wit, a Russian soldier is amazed at the tidiness of the German landscape the moment he crosses the frontier, the regimentation of the brick houses, the pigsties, and the wellheads. The electric lighting deep in the rural interior, and the well-kept roads through the clean, practically shaven forests bespeak an inhuman cleanliness and parade ground order shocking to a Russian peasant accustomed to the filthy dreariness of his home and village. Six from this flow dozens of pages of description of Russian military disorganization and slovenliness, with a chain of command and general officer corps corrupted by a thoroughly rotten czarist system. Russian generals make alcoholic toasts over heavy lunches in the middle of a military campaign. A withdrawal is ordered after gaining ground in a horrific battle, merely to protect a general's reputation in the expectation of further losses. At the highest levels there is almost always the avoidance of risk and the rewarding of mediocrity. By writing so well about the past he is also writing about the present. Solzhenitsyn, the nationalist, would be saddened by the Russian military catastrophe in the early phases of the Ukraine war. But he certainly wouldn't be shocked by it. Solzhenitsyn's sympathy is rather with the middle-level officers, who all bore the indelible impress of a similar background, army tradition, long spells of garrison service in a world isolated from the rest of society, a sense of alienation, of being despised by that society and ridiculed by liberal writers. 1117 Solzhenitsyn is the ultimate patriot, who, with a deep belief in an Orthodox Christian God, recognizes the primacy of culture and empathizes with the military, even as he must expose every aspect of a decadent and autocratic system that has failed its own people. Solzhenitsyn's uniqueness rests on his deep political conservatism, married to a narrative genius akin to Tolstoy's, and encompassing, like that ere her master, so many universes, from the horrors of the Romanian front in World War I, to the exaltations of falling in love in middle age, to the fantastic dinners in private rooms with masses of smoked salmon and sturgeon, bouillon, sour cream, and Rowan berry vodka. Solzhenitsyn sees an unnecessary war that chain reacts within a society spread across half the longitudes of the earth. It is a society that for some years already has been crumbling into chaos, with inflation, food shortages, complete bureaucratic dysfunction, a dynasty bordering on sheer helplessness and irresolution, and a rowdy Duma given to endless, flowery, and directionless speeches in the worst of parliamentary traditions. 18 Here, much more so than even in Weimar Germany, is the very texture of anarchy, with crowds assaulting police with stones and chunks of ice, while the police are in turn afraid of the Cossacks. Criminals are released from prisons. Soldiers desert from the army after nearly beating to death their officers. Mutinies lead to the collapse of the Baltic fleet. It is as if the entire Russian military organization is being eaten away by microbes. The army, the most stable of society's organizations, is melting and spilling away. 9 Gangs of arsonists set fire to public buildings. Entire staffs disappear from government offices. Youths tear down a statue of the great modernizing Prime Minister Stolypin. Meanwhile, congeries of parties and factions within parties are left to debate among themselves. Loose, drunken talk postulates that if only the government would change, everything would become better and more humane. There is general jubilation. Bands play in the streets. Strangers embrace at the thought of being liberated from the Tsar. There is almost a romance about the future, about any fate save for the czarist present. Of course, nobody at this point in time could foresee the vast Bolshevik death machine about to come next, just as nobody in the heady, artistic, and chaotic days of Weimar could foresee Hitler and the Nazis, and just as nobody alive now can foresee exactly how another unnecessary war, this time Vladimir Putin's in Ukraine, might chain react with other upheavals to forge a new world of permanent crisis. World War I was an unnecessary war that by virtue of its global scale ultimately had vast consequences, the birth of Nazism and Communism. The Ukraine War, despite its panorama of death and destruction, is not of the same magnitude. Nevertheless, it occurs at a time of greater global integration, so that its effects, in coming years, could also have the most serious of consequences, for better or worse. Crucially, it is the very confining integration of our world through technology that gives every large event within it an added significance, so that there is no time to catch our breath. We are constantly being overwhelmed. Solzhenitsyn's description of Russia in disarray vaguely reflects on what we ourselves are up against in many parts of the earth. Are we any more perceptive now about what awaits our planet than were the Russians of 1917, or all of Europe in 1914, and, for that matter, the Germans of the 1920s and early 1930s? Order, no matter how complex the social organism, rests upon some kind of chain of command, or multiple chains of command. Hierarchy is everything, especially in Russia, which was a huge and geographically endless organism lacking a real middle class. And it is the melting away of hierarchy that Solzhenitsyn describes in almost tactile terms. Institutions like the royal family, the imperial bureaucracy, the Duma, and the police gradually cease to function, or, even to answer properly to each other in the course of these novels. In this entire revolutionary process, what pierces most through the intelligent reader's consciousness is the madness of crowds coupled with the romance and irresistibility of extremism, so that a minority ends up moving history. Listen to Solzhenitsyn's timeless words, writing in the present tense during World War I. For a long time now it has been dangerous to stand in the way of revolution, and risk-free to assist it. Those who have renounced all traditional Russian values, the revolutionary horde, the locusts from the abyss, vilify and blaspheme and no one dares challenge them. A left-wing newspaper can print the most subversive of articles, a left-wing speaker can deliver the most incendiary of speeches, but just try pointing out the dangers of such utterances and the whole leftist camp will raise a howl of denunciation. 20. Nobody interferes with the mob, least of all the polished and oh-so-civilized Russian intelligentsia, who see the radical left as composed of a purer and distilled archetype of their own values, and only awake from their dreams when it is too late. That is another of the pillars of the tragedy, as revealed by Solzhenitsyn. The tyranny of perfect virtue in regard to race and foreign policy that has swarmed over our elite universities in recent years would obviously have terrified Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn is a deeply moral man of liberty, as the political philosopher Daniel J. Mahoney has observed. Yet as a man of liberty he realizes, as all conservatives do, that without order, yet once again, there is no freedom for any man. And the greater the disorder, the greater the repression to follow. Of all the characters in Solzhenitsyn's saga who are not fictional but historical, the most vividly realized is Vladimir Lenin, whom Solzhenitsyn captures in exile in Switzerland in the pages of November 1916. Lenin, as a contemporary of his once put it, is a block of granite, someone who has no humanity and is permanently focused on a problem. Lenin's milieu in November 1916 is an émigré world of Russian revolutionaries in Zurich and Geneva, a world brilliantly depicted by Joseph Conrad in his three novel Under Western Eyes. Conrad's characters resemble, as one critic observed, apes of a sinister jungle, in which Conrad announces that the spirit of Russia is the spirit of cynicism. For that is the mark of Russian autocracy and of Russian revolt, so that revolutions begin with idealism and end with fanaticism. 2. Solzhenitsyn is not cynical about Russia the way that Conrad, the Pole, is. But his portrayal of Lenin is, nevertheless, quite merciless. All that Lenin lacked was breadth. The savage, intolerant narrowness of the born schismatic harnessed his tremendous energies to futilities, fragmenting this group, dissociating himself from that, wasting his strength in meaningless struggles, with nothing to show except mounds of scribbled paper. This schismatic narrowness doomed him to sterility in Europe, left him no future except in Russia but also made him indispensable for any activity there. Indispensable now. And that is the point. Once out of Europe and back in Petrograd, Lenin becomes the most focused man in Russia, indeed perhaps the only focused man in Russia, a man whose narrow mind grinding like the gears of a clock concentrates on one issue. In this, he is like Hitler in the late 1920s and early 1930s. While everyone is debating politics, Lenin, like Hitler, meticulously plans how to actually seize power, which, as Solzhenitsyn's vast canvas makes clear, is, as they say, lying in the streets waiting to be picked up, as it was in Weimar Berlin. Indeed, in chaotic, disorderly, vulnerable moments, the politicians and the intelligentsia can be paralyzed by the singular and fanatical people who have true focus, relying on faltering institutions to stop or slow them. As an eyewitness journalist in Petrograd at the time, the American John Reed, puts it in 10 days that shook the world, the Bolsheviki, in one night, had dissipated the old regime, as one blows away smoke. At 2 in the morning on November 7, 1917, as the Bolshevik takeover began, Lenin said to Trotsky, "From being on the run to supreme power, that's too much. It makes me dizzy. This is human agency, the power of the individual, at its heights, though not the kind that intellectual idealists contemplate. There is just one buttress, the spell of the Tsar's name," someone remarks in March 1917, Note 3, Book 1. The people are generally indifferent to the various parties and programs but not to the fact that they have a Tsar. Of all the violence depicted in these books, perhaps the most terrifying is the sight of the Tsar's full-length portrait hanging in the Duma, shredded by bayonets. Despite all of its monumental faults, the monarchy was the only graspable fact of stability in Russia. However backward, reactionary, and ineffectual the monarchy was, longevity had provided Nicholas II's royal line with legitimacy, allowing him to rule without the sharpened steel of any of the extreme ideologies of the 20th century, with all their frightening isms. This is why, as explained by the philosopher Daniel Mahoney, Solzhenitsyn came to see the often forgotten February Revolution that brought the Democrat Alexander Kerensky to power as the true revolution and the enduring disaster, because of the utter illusion it presented of a stable middle ground, since it toppled the monarchical order and led Russia into complete anarchy, from which a Bolshevik coup, the October Revolution, was only subsequent. 26. The swinging of history's weight, as Solzhenitsyn puts it, can be determined by the barest of contingencies. 27. Had Nicholas not abdicated for both himself and for his son, had Grand Duke Mikhail Alexandrovich not been forced to abdicate almost immediately after the crown had passed from Nicholas to him, had the somewhat more capable Grand Duke Nicholas Nikolaevich been able to secure the throne following his military command in the Caucasus, had Stolypin not been assassinated, had Kerensky had better political instincts and been more than just a gifted and inspiring speech maker, had Tsarevich Alexei's hemophilia not distorted the life and politics of the royal family, much might have been different. The Bolsheviks might not have gained control in the way that they did and when they did. As in Weimar, the wages of disorder meant that too much hung on a thread, and because the Russian Revolution itself hung on a thread, so did the trajectory of the 20th century. The seminal crime of the 20th century, which given the various regimes to come in Russia, carried over with its second and third order effects into the 21st century, was the murder of Nicholas II's family, including all the children, in July 1918 in Ekaterinburg, probably ordered by Lenin himself. If you could deliberately kill children at point-blank range with guns and bayonets, well then, you could kill millions. We can also include the murder of the entire Iraqi royal family in July 1958 by Nasserite military officers, 40 years to the month after the killing of the Romanovs, which led to a line of radical military dictators culminating in Saddam Hussein. Then there was the forced abdication of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in Iran, just as he was contemplating reforms, which led to the Islamic Revolution. If the Pahlavi dynasty had remained on the throne, Iran might have evolved in the late 20th century into a pro-Western constitutional monarchy and, in economic terms, become a Middle Eastern version of South Korea. To repeat, it was Churchill who preferred the restoration of the Romanovs and Hohenzollerns both, if only as figureheads, to prevent a Lenin or Hitler. In its first few months alone, Lenin's secret police executed almost 15,000 people, nearly twice the number of those executed by the Romanovs in the entire previous 100 years. 28. This then was the 20th century, the axe-like ending of the old world with all of its stabilizing traditions, allowing for the rise of abstract and utopian movements from the Nazis to the Bolsheviks to Pol Pot and Ayatollah Khomeini, each in its own way constituting a dictatorship of perfect virtue, since in each case ideology was paramount. 4. As Kissinger wrote in A World Restored, the most fundamental problem of politics is not the control of wickedness but the limitation of righteousness. 29. It is self-righteousness that lies at the heart of the worst tyrannies, the belief that your opponents can be destroyed because they are in your eyes fundamentally illegitimate. This is what the vast anarchy across the whole of Russia finally wrought. Solzhenitsyn was a conservative because he believed in tradition, and therefore in moderation. His Red Wheel warns of a future with all its terrifying technological and ideological innovations. It can never be out of date. Of course, there will be no return in the 21st century to anything approaching monarchy, with its inherent legitimacy that staves off the compulsion for extremist ideology and violent control. We are now completely on our own in a world made intimate by technology, with its tendency to be destabilized by simplistic social media slogans and fragile financial dominoes, and though its individual parts may in significant measure be moderately and democratically governed, its very close interactions, including the shattering of powers from within, great and small, make for a geopolitical Weimar. In this geopolitical Weimar, while monarchical rule, aside from the Arabian Peninsula with its kings and sultans and emirs, has faded into near oblivion, the legacy of totalitarianism, especially communism, remains both overbearing and deadening, contributing to our underlying instability. China and North Korea are still officially communist societies, while three quarters of a century of communism, including decades of Stalinism, have exacted enough civilizational damage in Russia to have left its imprint on Vladimir Putin's murderous rule. Totalitarianism, which essentially means that no action or any thought even by any human being is allowed to exist beyond the purview of the state and without the permission of the state, is an invention of modernism. It bears modernism's disdain for the past and traditions and traditional methods of rule, which include monarchy foremost. One can observe even today the physical damage wrought by communist totalitarianism in Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's industrialization of architecture, with its prefabricated buildings, reinforced concrete, and standardized apartments that continue to deface many a former Soviet bloc city today and rob it of its humanity and uniqueness. 30. As we will see later in more detail in this book, though communism died in Europe in 1989, the spiritual and political destruction it caused never mind the architectural damage lingers still, and is a supporting actor in our permanent crisis. We are still not done with communism, even while the future as defined by technology gallops forward. All ages are ages of transition, but never have such monumental transitions been advanced at such an uneven pace as they are now. Of course, there is more to history than vast impersonal forces such as communism, technology, geopolitics, and so on. There are also personalities and human agency, with all of their implied contingencies. Vladimir Putin has been the most dangerous Russian leader since Stalin, Xi Jinping is as relentless and ideological as Mao Zedong, Donald Trump, whose political career may he in the past tense, is more vain and superficial than von Papen even. The point is, there is the raw material in today's world that can force a true cataclysm, or at the least keep this permanent crisis of world order going. There will be no let up from the headlines, in other words. Forget Hitler. Every tyrant is unique, just as every hero is. And just as technology liberates, technological demons will abound. The key element in all of this will be closeness. We will all Eurasia, Africa, North, and South America be exposed to each other's crises as never before. In this, the mid and late 21st century will be to the 20th century as the 20th was to the 19th and even the 18th. That is, the pace and quality of connectivity of closeness will unceasingly accelerate. That will deliver many wonders, of course. But it will be the disease variants, the toxic destabilizing elements, that can threaten to overwhelm us. Geography is not disappearing. It is only shrinking. Indeed, the smaller the world becomes because of technology, the more that every place in it becomes important. Every place, every river and mountain range, will be strategic. A coup in the Sahelian country of Niger, like what happened there in 2023, will expose the fragility of our world as much as an economic crisis in China. Think of an old wristwatch, so small, but once you start to take the watch apart it suddenly becomes vast and complicated. Such is our globe today and will be in the coming decades. Let me explain our world by way of the Sicilian expedition of the early 5th century BC. It demonstrates exactly how geography will be both instructive and compressed in the mid-21st century. For decades, strategists have used this military adventure of ancient Athens, documented by Thucydides, as a metaphor for both the Vietnam and Iraq wars. Athens had gone to war in support of allies in far-off Sicily, only to become embroiled for a number of years in a military quagmire there. After steeply building up its invasion force, Athens had to retreat with its reputation in tatters. Sicily is next door to Greece, whereas Vietnam and Iraq are half a world removed from the United States. Yet, as we know, the contraction of geography on account of transportation technology has rendered Vietnam and Iraq as close to America in practical terms as Sicily was to Greece, or, put another way, the absence of such technology in 5th century BC. Athens rendered Sicily as distant as Vietnam and Iraq were to America. Thus, in either case, the analogy holds. The same might be said for the world situation and Weimar. Because of digital communications, intercontinental missiles, jet travel, space satellites, and so much else, different parts of the globe now affect each other as intimately as different parts of Germany affected each other in the 1920s and early 1930s. Of course, Germany had one language, and did not have oceans to divide it. So the differences between this world and Weimar are vast, yet the similarities are intriguing. Again, the shrinkage of geography has offered us an analogy, however imperfect, that did not previously exist. Will this new global Weimar have the cataclysmic fate of the old German one? Or will it find a measure of stability like in 1920s Germany during the years of Gustav Stresemann? For that interregnum might have continued indefinitely were it not for the Great Depression that afflicted the entire developed world and sent Weimar spiraling downward. Hitler was not inevitable. There were other possibilities. Nevertheless, keep in mind that we increasingly have crises that unify the world while at the same time threatening it, and also dividing it. COVID-19 and climate change have, despite all the trouble they have caused, and will cause, not had the very targeted and cataclysmic effect on the globe as, for example, the Great Depression had on Germany, which brought Hitler to power. But give it all time. Climate change and pandemics are relentless, especially given absolute rises in population for a few decades yet in parts of the world, and by people increasingly living in environmentally fragile zones, subject to landslides, rising sea levels, and the like. And this is to say nothing of wars and great power fractures. And thus now we come to our own world. John von Neumann was a brilliant and visionary child prodigy who grew up in the decadent, eclectic culture of late Habsburg Budapest and immigrated to the United States to escape Hitler. Able to quote Voltaire, Goethe, and Thucydides by heart, he also worked on developing both the atomic and hydrogen bombs. Three few have ever combined such literary, historical, and scientific genius. To call him one of the great mathematicians of his day, which he undoubtedly was, would be to diminish him. In the middle of the 20th century, Von Neumann contended that a sparsely populated planetary geography had always acted to constrain both military and technological advances. Guns could fire farther and farther away and be more accurate, but the Earth was still a big place and could therefore absorb almost any shock due to empty space and sparsely inhabited territory. Yet von Neumann worried that geography was starting to lose the battle. The Earth's finite size would increasingly be a force for instability, as populations expanded and military hardware and computer software ultimately condensed distances on the geopolitical map. This is an easy change to miss because it is gradual, warned Yale political scientist Paul Bracken in 1999, echoing von Neumann. 32. Actually, this had all begun to happen in earnest a half century before von Neumann made his perceptive observation. The British geographer Halford Mackinder at the very beginning of the 20th century electrified much of the intellectual world with his now famous pivot theory, which stated that since the Eurasian supercontinent was soon to be connected by railways, the heartland, or vast center of Eurasia, held the key to world power, as it was equidistant from all the strategic points in any direction. In building to that conclusion, Mackinder fathomed that the great European imperial powers, by expanding their political control into the most distant corners of Africa and Asia, had essentially mapped out the entire Earth, with no more room left to expand, meaning that their energies could no longer be expended in faraway conquests of jungles and deserts, and so the great powers would increasingly turn on each other. Wars would become worldwide in scale, as every place could be contested. Thus did Mackinder vaguely intuit two world wars and the Cold War decades before they happened. Every explosion of social forces, he wrote in 1904, instead of being dissipated in a surrounding circuit of unknown space and barbaric chaos, will henceforth be sharply re-echoed from the far side of the globe, and weak elements in between will be shattered in consequence. Almost everywhere there will be consequential and connected human habitation, thus every place will become of critical importance. There will be no place to escape to. The great powers will be trapped together on a finite planet, exactly as von Neumann so simply and elegantly conceptualized in the middle of the 20th century. World War I may have represented the first time in such stark terms that the great powers of Europe and North America were all bound up in one system. But attrition of the same adds up to big change. Indeed, World War II saw all the major continents of the temperate zone Europe, North America, and Asia integrated into the same destructive conflict system, a world system that was only deepened and intensified during the almost half-century-long Cold War. And since then, into the 2020s, there has been a steady advance of technology that has made the world and its conflicts increasingly claustrophobic. A crisis in one part of the Earth can easily and instantaneously migrate to the other side of the Earth. Because every place is strategic, the possibilities of conflict become more numerous than ever. And yet no world government has ever been on the horizon. The United Nations has served either as an extension of great power conflicts, without mitigating them, or as a forum for action on those conflicts, particularly in the far-off corners of the developing world, like sub-Saharan Africa, that the great powers at least deem secondary or non-essential. As for global institutions like the G7 or G20, the more accurate description, as Eurasia Group President Ian Bremmer has noted, is G0. That is, no group of countries can consistently work together in order to alleviate the world's individual crises. The Ukraine war has been a matter between Russia and the United States. NATO unity was not the key factor allowing the Ukrainians to survive as impressively as they did for months on end. They survived because of the gargantuan power of the US economy and defense establishment, which allowed for the transfer of many tens of billions of dollars in arms to Kiev, next to which aid from Europe was less significant. The fact is that no supranational institution can ultimately replace the self-interest of states, something that is itself founded on the naked needs of the mass of citizens, average people, rather than of the enlightened liberal few. Progress on global issues like climate change and world poverty generate more headlines than dramatic action, given the actual scale of those problems. Meanwhile, territorial battles, such as Ukraine, Taiwan, and Gaza, will generate age-old behavior based on naked national interest, and have far more immediate consequences based on blood and treasure, even as their tendency to interact with other battles elsewhere on the planet will multiply. Global instability will intensify, even as effete and awkward moments like G7 leader photo ops prove ineffectual and beside the point, because of the way that military, economic, financial, and technological integration will continue to magnify future crises beyond imagination. Columbia University historian and polymath Adam Tuz has constructed a series of crisis pictures, Krisenbilder, as he prefers to call them, using the German equivalent, that demonstrate the overwhelming interconnectivity of the world's various crises. During the Ukraine war, Tuz's crisis map was so complex it became nearly illegible. I counted nearly 36 arrows connecting in different directions about 24 points of interaction that included the Omicron virus, the Ukraine war, the risk of nuclear escalation, the boycott of Russian gas, rising oil prices along with those of food, refugees in Eastern Europe, the risk of stagflation, the climate crisis, and so on. Tuz provided additional chronological context with the Ukraine war still raging. To make matters even more complicated, he begins, this synchronic presentation obscures the historical genesis of these forces. Stresses in energy and food markets were already very evident in 2021. The war has the impact it has because it has exacerbated existing tensions. Food prices were already rising in 2021. Energy markets were stressed well before the war broke out. Now both stresses are knotted together with the war. 34. And all this is to say little about financial markets themselves, whose stock and bond exchanges affect the wealth of the global middle and upper classes directly, and the working and poorer classes indirectly. Financial markets intersect with all of Tuz's above crises by registering the level of risk and instability they entail. Now that technology has united financial markets the world over, in addition to wealth-generating mechanisms, they are extensions of military and ideological conflict systems, and will become more so in an age of total war, the new hallmark of Russian and Chinese strategy, in which the enemy seeks not only to inflict damage on the conventional battlefield and on key infrastructure, but also to inflict economic pain and demoralize the population through disinformation. This is how geopolitics will become more integrated with market fluctuations. It is true that 20 years of warfare involving the United States in the Middle East did not affect stock markets very much, which relatively easily priced in disruptions in the oil market. On the other hand, the Ukraine war, by intersecting with many of the other crises on Tuz's map, certainly has had a slightly downward effect on markets by contributing to inflation through supply chain disruptions. In fact, the combination of COVID-19 and the Ukraine war, two things one wouldn't ordinarily combine in the same category, by disrupting supply chains contributed to a measure of inflation and deglobalization. 35. Keep in mind that whatever the effect the Ukraine war has had on other crises, supply chains, food, oil, nuclear threats, financial markets, Ukraine and Russia are still exceedingly small parts of the world economy, thus the war provided but a taste of what may be in store for us. Nevertheless, a war lasting only a few days in the South and East China Seas, or in Taiwan, bringing the world's three largest economies, the United States, China, Japan, to blows with high-end weaponry, could affect markets drastically, and obviously for the worse. And that's even if the war does not spread beyond those two maritime spheres, which may be doubtful in this cyber and digital age. There are also other things to consider. What if such a war goes on for weeks, if not longer? Artificial intelligence, AI, will play a role in naval weapons systems of the near and middle-term future, perhaps setting off responses and chain reactions that take missile and other attacks further than any of the warring parties in the Pacific intend, deep into the interior of China, for example, where Chinese missile batteries are located. Forget World War II naval battles like the Battle of the Philippine Sea. This will be a battle of automated weapons and space-based navigational systems. The rivalry between the United States and China, unlike the Cold War rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, is layered in arcane features such as debt valuations and high finance, as well as in those weapons systems, as both countries' economies are delicately interlinked. China, as the world's second largest economy, will be even harder to boycott than Russia during the Ukraine war. Such a war between China and the United States could embroil the world economy in a so-called doom loop. And as for the military aspect of such a war, do not expect the Chinese to be as incompetent in their strategy and war machine as the Russians initially were. The Chinese are great students of war. They studied obsessively the American-led intervention in the Balkans in the 1990s, as well as the two Gulf Wars. We can therefore assume that they have studied every aspect of the Ukraine war, military, political, and economic. If they ever do decide to invade Taiwan, they will be better equipped to do so precisely because of lessons learned from observing Ukraine. Or on the other hand, the spectacle of vast American military aid to Ukraine might also dissuade China from ever attempting such an invasion. In any case, the specter of years or decades of strategic competition between the United States and China will not merely constitute another Cold War, an antiquated term for an earlier age of technology. While the old Soviet Union did not have an economy as such, China's economy and cutting-edge consumer products and digital networks are deeply integrated into Western markets. Of course, geopolitics did, in fact, affect world markets to a limited degree during the Cold War, yet this trend is now about to increase by multiples. The fact that a military conflict in the breadbasket of Ukraine halted grain deliveries to needy Middle Eastern and African countries for a time, driving up worldwide commodity prices, was a relatively simple and mechanical phenomenon, of the kind we have seen in past ages of warfare. But the geopolitical fault line between the United States and China could yet have the most profound and unpredictable consequences on supply chains and digital operating systems. This is because complexity leads to fragility, in which any of innumerable nodal points under attack can disrupt a system as a whole. We may be able to more easily predict the second and third order effects of a nuclear weapon being detonated in a war than we can predict the effects of a massive cyber conflict, in which red lines have yet to be clearly delineated. We don't even know the limits of cyber and information warfare, enhanced by artificial intelligence, which conceivably could do far more damage in different ways than a nuclear exchange. The cyber attacks we have thus far seen have been limited in scope, such as hacking a company's computer system or even, as the Chinese have done, hacking into the Pentagon's personnel files. But such things as taking down a leading world stock market or electric power grid may soon be within the capabilities of criminal groups and certain states. Cyber attacks could spread in unintended and unknown ways, like chemical or biological attacks. 6. We are still at a primitive stage of this phenomenon, and at a relatively early stage of diplomacy in regulating it. Of course, the optimists can also be right. So I do realize how obsessively negative I am being. After all, among so many other good developments, extreme world poverty has decreased, technology is defeating disease, people are living longer and longer. But it is precisely those and many other kinds of technological breakthroughs that will go alongside, as well as intensify, destabilizing interactions among states and groups and people and markets, even as new and striving middle classes arising out of poverty incessantly demand more and more of their governments. Middle classes are ungrateful. They want more and more. This is to say nothing of the building of ever more precise and lethal weapons systems for a species that has not known a century of peace in its hundreds of thousands of years of existence. Thus, I am warning in the tradition of anxious foresight. Optimism and pessimism can be perilous attitudes that undergird policy. But of the two, optimism is apt to kill with greater certainty, writes Cohn S. Gray, the late British-American scholar on geopolitics and military affairs. Whereas pessimism may inspire a grand strategy and especially defense preparation, optimism has the potential to risk national safety and even international order more generally. 37. Thus, I will continue in this vein. While cyber weapons and forms of artificial intelligence may supersede them in destructive power, we also need to remember that nuclear weapons, a mid-20th century creation, are still with us. In 1957, a 34-year-old Henry Kissinger in his book Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy defined the problem we presently face. Though the obvious danger back then was thermonuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, Kissinger said the less obvious but more likely threat was a limited war using smaller tactical nuclear weapons mixed with conventional ones. In such a limited war, he explained, the psychological equation is, paradoxically, constantly shifting against the side which seems to be winning, since the closer that side comes to victory, the more likely it is that the weaker side will resort to nuclear weapons. What's more, the introduction of nuclear weapons in such a war would occur under the worst possible conditions in the confusion of battle, with each side having no previous experience to serve as a guide. Of course, this was an issue in 2022 and 2023 in the Ukraine war, when the Russians were losing, or at least not achieving their stated goals, and with President Vladimir Putin indirectly threatening the use of low-yield tactical nuclear weapons. There is also the perennial India-Pakistan nuclear standoff, with Pakistan, the weaker party, more likely to resort to such weapons, just as Kissinger predicted. In fact, the destruction of many, if not most, hydrogen bombs in the wake of the Cold War and the development of new and sophisticated kinds of low-yield tactical nuclear bombs only makes Kissinger's concerns more relevant, as if he foresaw the new era of warfare. Nuclear weapons continue to have their uses, and not just for the losing or weaker side in a conventional war. A leader armed with nuclear weapons, or any kind of weapons of mass destruction for that matter, has protection against a foreign invasion. Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi gave up his weapons of mass destruction and the Americans consequently supported his overthrow and killing, as it was clear he had no defense against a popular revolt, and no large-scale unconventional weapons to use or threaten to use. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un kept his nuclear weapons and consequently the United States has not risked a war with his regime. Many a regime has, wants, and will want nuclear weapons in order to use them exactly the way that the Cold War superpowers did for half a century, to induce fear and, relatedly, as the supreme form of leverage. Putin has gotten significant use out of his nuclear arsenal during the Ukraine war. Merely by mentioning that, by the way, he had such weapons at his disposal, he got US President Joe Biden to be extra careful about the kinds of weapons his administration supplied the Ukrainians, and to seriously look for a way to end the war, for fear of backing Putin into a corner where he might use his nukes. Had Russia had no arsenal of nuclear weapons, the Biden administration would likely have supplied Ukraine with more kinds of weaponry much earlier than it did. Then there is the case of clerical Iran, which for decades concentrated obsessively on its nuclear program because it knew that even without detonating a nuke, its ability to intimidate its neighbors would increase several fold. Nuclear arsenals, or their equivalent, will probably always exist since you don't have to detonate a nuclear bomb in order to get value out of it. In the meantime, the visceral living memory of a nuclear attack in a war wanes with the passing of generations since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so that the inhibitions against using such weapons continue to decline, especially with the further development of small, battlefield nukes. This is especially true of leaderships and populations in places such as Russia and Pakistan. Nuclear weapons came into existence partly because of the absence of precision-guided munitions. Because you could rarely hit a distant target with reasonable accuracy, you aimed to do as much destruction as possible in the wider, surrounding area. The bigger the bomb the better, in other words. Indeed, that has been the story of warfare and weapons development throughout human history up until recently. Nuclear weapons were a culmination of a process that had begun with ancient catapults. But suddenly with the advent of precision-guided weapons, in turn derivative of the invention of microchips, state-induced violence becomes, theoretically at least, more tempting and less lethal. We saw this most famously for the first time in the 1991 Gulf War, in which American missiles fired from offshore in the Persian Gulf targeted specific buildings in Baghdad several hundred miles away. Remember that in conflicts such as World War II and Vietnam, whole areas had to be bombed in order to hit a specific target, such as a bridge or a factory, causing significant collateral damage, especially to civilians. This point still has held true, albeit to a much lesser extent, in the Gaza War, where Israel, with all of its smart bombs, still enforced significant damage on Palestinian civilian areas. As precision-guided munitions now become the preferred weapon of choice in the Western way of war, the chances of initiating violence may actually increase. The best example of this has been the campaign of assassination conducted by several American administrations, Democrat and Republican, against high-ranking Islamic terrorists, in which drones and fighter jets have been employed with precision-guided bombs. Of course, Ukraine was generally not an example of this, with its vast civilian casualties and destruction of infrastructure. That has been because of the general backwardness and intentional brutality of the Russian military, which deliberately has pursued a war of few limits against a large European civilian population, demonstrating that the propensity to kill on an industrial scale unfortunately remains a characteristic of the human species. Look at Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, and especially the Israeli military response. Nevertheless, there will be wars fought in the future, for better and worse, that will provide ever more clinical demonstrations of high-end weaponry. And these precision-guided weapons will in most cases be missiles of some sort. The Earth is on the verge of being completely encircled by overlapping missile ranges. As missiles come to overshadow slow-moving land armies, the Earth and its geopolitics experience yet another layer of claustrophobia. Missiles, in turn, are features of automated battle networks, like the Aegis combat system on U.S. Navy destroyers, with each destroyer packing enough firepower to partially demolish a big city. The lethality in terms of quantity, quality, and speed of the weapons unleashed on each ship, multiplied by the hundreds upon hundreds of surface and subsurface warships in the American and other First World navies, has always had the potential to engulf the Earth in violent conflict. This has gone largely unnoticed, partly because navies, situated offshore in the world's seas and oceans, go largely unseen, unless of course one happens to live near a naval base. Because all these weapons are subnuclear, the reticence about using them is reduced. Cool heads are all that has prevented us from destroying our own world. But don't assume that cool heads must always prevail in every instance, especially as the Chinese Navy achieves parity with our own, and even surpasses it. The Cold War with the Soviet Union remained peaceful in the heart of Europe, with mass violence restricted to the Third World periphery, largely because of the fear induced by thermonuclear bombs. But arsenals on that scale barely exist anymore, even as there has been a revolution in weaponry that, unlike hydrogen warheads, is meant to be used. Therefore, we should not automatically assume that the avoidance of head-on, great power war in the second half of the 20th century must continue deep into the 21st. The Ukraine war, in which Russia has conducted massive aerial bombardments of heavily populated civilian areas, should have alerted us to the fact that literally anything is possible now. The ultimate danger will always remain in losing our cool heads. Now you may ask, if cool heads have prevailed for many decades until now, why should they stop prevailing? After all, Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine may well be the exception that proves the rule. The more businesslike, bureaucratic, and technocratic Chinese compared to the Russians would never, at the end of the day, unleash such terror on Taiwan, regardless of their aims, and the United States will always be circumspect in launching any military responses. The problem with such comforting assumptions is that they assume moderate and realistic voices will always predominate in government. But that might not always be the case. And the reason has less to do with personalities than with the social and technological forces molding those personalities. The decades of cool decision-making, especially in the United States, coincided with the print and typewriter age, a form of technology that lent itself to objective and detailed explanations of issues, encouraging both the public and its leaders toward moderation. President Dwight Eisenhower, who represented the epitome of cool, analytical wisdom, is impossible to imagine in a digital video world of roiling passions ignited by social media. Even in his slower era, Eisenhower in the 1950s nearly committed to launching nuclear attacks on China over the fate of Quemoy and Matsu, islands in the Taiwan Strait held by Taiwan and claimed by the mainland. Eisenhower, in the end, would hold back from using nuclear weapons several times, when they might have ended the Korean War in circumstances more favorable to the United States at the beginning of his presidency, when they might have saved the French garrison at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam in 1954, and when they might have quelled Soviet threats to Berlin near the end of his presidency. Again and again, his advisers, who clearly were not motivated by containment as it is today understood, urged Eisenhower to use his nuclear arsenal. But Eisenhower always hesitated. 39 President Donald Trump, who, by contrast, represented the epitome of self-centered, emotional impulses, is impossible to imagine outside of a digital video world. Of course, there are many fundamental differences between Eisenhower and Trump, having nothing to do with technology. Eisenhower, after all, was a general and war hero. Trump avoided the military draft 5 times. But their differences are also symbolic of the different eras in history and technology in which they operated. The fact is that the communications revolution has changed the way our minds work. The Cold War overlapped with the print and typewriter age, which actually may have been as responsible for the avoidance of thermonuclear war as the fear of such bombs themselves. We now inhabit a world of megacities inflamed by social media, which rewards passion rather than cool analysis. And the new generation of leaders will be products of such forces as much as previous leaders were products of more quaint forces of communications. Certainly cool decision-making is still possible, as the Biden administration generally proved in its overly careful handling of the Ukraine war, and in its dogged attempts to get a ceasefire in Gaza, even as it backed Israel, a longtime American ally. But thinking coolly is just harder now. Remember that the White House has always wanted to be well regarded by the media. That has not changed. It's just that the media that the White House wants to be well regarded by has changed fundamentally, in the direction of right-wing and left-wing extremes, exacerbated by a noticeable increase in self-righteousness, and politicians have moved with the times. This fragile, finite earth of ours rests, above all, on moderation, which this new age of technology is fundamentally undermining. This is what at root fuels our permanent crisis. Remember that Weimar had moderate leaders, until one day it didn't. At least we can take solace in the fact that our institutions, as imperfect as they are far more robust than Weimar's. Anything is possible now because while technology has evolved, human nature hasn't, even as technology has made large-scale war more likely than during the age of hydrogen bombs. Man has such a propensity for violence that it actually required hydrogen bombs to keep him at least temporarily at bay. Violence during the Cold War was generally limited to the Third World and did not include the far more strategically important region of Europe itself. Putin's Ukraine war, like Hitler's various military aggressions, like Napoleon's attempt to militarily master Europe, brings up another matter aside from the loss of protection afforded by hydrogen bombs, and which periodically plagues history, and will, we must believe, continue to plague it, that is, the problem of Kissinger's revolutionary chieftains, the epitome of the dark side of human nature, men who lead revolutionary states. Such men and states appear which boldly proclaim that their purpose is to destroy the existing structure of world order and to recast it completely, Kissinger explains in Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy. The powers that represent the status quo are at a profound disadvantage vis-à-vis a revolutionary power. They have everything to gain from believing in its good faith, for the tranquility they seek is unattainable without it. All their instincts will cause them to seek to integrate the revolutionary power into the legitimate framework with which they are familiar and which to them seems natural. But while the status quo powers by their very nature seek a static condition in world affairs, the revolutionary power, also by its very nature, seeks the opposite, the overturning of the established order. That is why one of the marks of a revolutionary power is always to fill a vacuum. For status quo powers, negotiations and conferences are a means to make progress, For revolutionary power they are a means only to gain time, until the next aggression. 40. We can see this process transparently and famously at work in the actions of Napoleon and Hitler, and much more recently in those of Putin, who for two decades kept chipping away at Western resolve through the creation of frozen conflicts at various places in the Caucasus, in the Balkans, Transnistria, and in eastern Ukraine, to say nothing of his annexation of Crimea in 2014 and his military intervention in Syria the following year. Wherever Putin identified a vacuum, he filled it. His full-bore, World War II-style invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 was the culmination of a process in which the United States, NATO, and especially Germany kept trying to integrate Putin into the established order and over time signally failed to do so. These attempts at integrating a revolutionary chieftain involved a good deal of self-deception on the part of the status quo powers, as it usually does. Though Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Hungary's Viktor Orban do not rise to the level of revolutionary chieftains, Europe's pleading with them to only be reasonable has achieved no positive result. For such failures of the established order to deal with revolutionary powers are not aberrations but the very stuff of history, which provides it with both its drama and direction, and which we can, therefore, assume will plague us periodically in the future, a future that will feature more exquisite weaponry and a further binding together of the various geographies of the earth. Again, it is the shrinkage of geography by technology that may allow crises in the mold of Ukraine and Gaza to spread across time zones and chain react with crises elsewhere. Ukraine is now, Gaza is now, Taiwan is an example of the near future. Chinese President Xi Jinping may be more businesslike and less rough-hewn than Russian President Vladimir Putin. But Xi, by publicly proclaiming his desire to unify Taiwan with mainland China, by force if necessary, is very much a revolutionary chieftain, seeking Chinese primacy in the greater Asia-Pacific. Furthermore, don't assume that a war over Taiwan will stay in Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait, especially since Taiwan borders the other zones of contention between China and the United States, and between China and Japan, the South and East China Seas. And that is to say nothing about China's missile batteries located deep inside its mainland, which would become legitimate targets of the United States the moment hostilities begin. We are dealing here with a war zone emphasizing naval, air, and space power of far more sophisticated and high-end military depth than in the World War I and World War II-like battles of Ukraine. Ukraine has been a hybrid war, bearing attributes of the past and the future. Taiwan would be much more in the Star Wars style of the mid-21st century. Indeed, a short, sharp war lasting a few days in the Western Pacific may be the stuff of Pentagon war games, but we should never assume that such wars will remain short and sharp. They could just as easily become protracted and epic in geographical breadth, as other wars have. Weimar ended with Adolf Hitler. The globe-spanning Weimar of the 21st century will almost certainly not end that way. But if history is any guide, it will be plagued by other, lesser sorts of revolutionary chieftains, probably many, given the state of our world. However, before we go further, I must address a nagging issue for the reader: my assumption that human nature itself will not improve. How do I know this? I don't. But I assume it to be true. To explain why, let me confront the argument made by the most serious and articulate spokesman for the belief that human nature is, in fact, improving, Harvard cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker, whose 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, was an intellectual event. Pinker's 800-page book makes a stark and unambiguous claim, that humankind throughout the centuries has become progressively less violent, and that this trend will continue. Pinker is not saying that violence has declined in an absolute sense, but in a crucial relative sense. World War II killed 55 million people and was, in absolute terms in sheer numbers, that is history's greatest atrocity. But once one adjusts that figure to the percentage of world population killed between 1939 and 1914, World War II becomes only the ninth worst atrocity, after the 8th century and Lushan Revolt, the 13th century Mongol conquests, The 17th through 19th century slave trade, the 17th century fall of the Ming Dynasty, and others. The most succinct rebuttal to Pinker's thesis was provided by Yale University historian Timothy Snyder in Foreign Affairs. 34 Snyder notes that it simply may not be true that the violent instinct in man has declined. It is only that in relative terms the carrying capacity of the earth to support large populations through fertilizers and antibiotics is winning the race against machine guns. Snyder explains that modernity and education have not pacified man as Pinker claims, for it is impossible to imagine the religious wars in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries without the advent of the printing press. Snyder's conclusion is that Pinker loses sight of the modern world in which we actually live. Indeed, modernity itself, the industrial and post-industrial ages, has brought us everything from tanks to aircraft carriers to atomic bombs, and every historical actor from Adolf Hitler to Mao Zedong to Osama bin Laden. Pinker counters that World War II and the Holocaust in Europe were not the product of modernity per se, but of the leadership decisions of one individual with a mesmerizing force, Hitler. Pinker also notes the statistical anomaly of two world wars in little more than a generation has been followed by a long peace, suggesting that interstate war, the greatest of killers, could historically be on the ebb. The British pacifist Norman Angell published a book similar to Pinker's in 1909, The Great Illusion, which declared that war no longer made economic sense and might thus go out of fashion. World War I erupted 5 years later and Angell was humiliated. Pinker defends Angell, saying that the latter may have the last laugh in coming decades, which could see the end to both militarism and the inevitability of war, through secular education and the feminizing of culture worldwide. Unfortunately, geopolitics and its attendant realism, which Pinker disparages, will not cooperate. Indeed, it is hard to read Pinker without thinking of the Ukraine and Gaza wars, which erupted a decade after he published his book, and which in absolute and thematic terms undermine his general argument. As for human nature in general, rather than improving as he implies, it may just be channeling its worst impulses in equally deadly, albeit less violent, directions through the internet and cyberspace, where all manner of perversions from pornography to phishing to criminal hacking to identity theft and much more constitute regular, can we say, normal occurrences. Humankind is just as perverse as ever. It's just that the technology has evolved. In the end, ironically enough, Pinker is up against not just human nature, but the fact that, as he correctly states, it is often just a small number of men that can cause violent havoc across a region and the earth. Yes, Pinker is right, no Hitler, no Holocaust. And for that matter, no Osama bin Laden, no 9/11, and, therefore, no Iraq War. But that is the whole point. History is driven not just by geopolitics and other vast impersonal forces, but also by the actions of individual men, charismatic men, who will lead others to violence, who reject the rationalism of the Enlightenment and seek to be pure and authentic in regard to their instincts. And the more routinized and artificial life becomes on account of technology, the more that human nature in Pinker's worldview is pacified and feminized, the more likely that the instincts of certain leaders will rebel against those very tendencies, making them revolutionary chieftains. The late British-American military and strategic analyst Cohn S. Gray published Another Bloody Century, Future Warfare in 2005, 7 years before Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature. Yet, Gray explains the fact of the Ukraine war, as well as dramatically rising military tensions in the Pacific, to say nothing of the Israel-Gaza war, in a way that Pinker does not. Gray, starting from further back in time, is more visionary. The main theme of his book, published at the height of the global war on terrorism in the Middle East, when great power struggles between America and Russia, as well as between America and China, were on few people's minds, was that great power rivalries and perhaps even major interstate wars would form the core of history in the 21st century. How did Gray arrive at this conclusion despite very little evidence for it in the world of 2005? Simple. The past is the only guide to the future, he explains. The social institution known as war survived the agrarian revolution of 6000 BC, and the industrial and scientific revolutions of the 19th and 20th centuries. It should be a safe prediction to expect warfare to adapt, or be adapted, to whatever changes technology, economies, and social and political mores will lay up for us in the future. In fact, Gray explains how globalization and climate change, by connecting various crises with each other and igniting struggles over scarcer resources, can increase the probabilities of war. Then there is the expansion of military activities into space and cyberspace happening in the same vein that warfare spread to the oceans following the late medieval and early modern age of exploration. 43. I do not believe in progress in security affairs, Gray declares. I am impressed, however, by our ability to muddle through. For Gray, thinkers like Pinker, rather than insightful, are merely reflective of their own cultural milieu. Our debellicized West, Gray explains, is an island of calm in a sea of troubles. Whether one views that fact as a beacon of hope for the world, or as a perilous source of self-delusion, is a matter for individual choice. 44. Of course, that sea of calm must be qualified. The reader will come up with any number of examples of the West in disarray, from school shootings to the erosion of behavioral norms to cultural decline in general to the decline in our own democracy, which I will explore later in this book. Gray is obviously being relative, since the world beyond the West is even more tumultuous than the West itself, while the West as a civilizational phenomenon slowly dissolves and merges with the rest of the world. And as that happens, again, as the world contracts, Gray's vision is that deeper into the 21st century we will see both the expansion of war into space and cyberspace, and the commingling of both regular interstate war and irregular guerrilla-type war. Of course, this is already happening. As the analyst and former U.S. Army officer Ralph Peters wrote 2 years before September 11th, technologies come and go, but the primitive endures. War is just beginning, in the opinion of the Israeli military historian Martin van Creveld, whose book The Transformation of War, published in 1991, is considered a breakthrough classic. Van Creveld explains how it was not predetermined that only states would make war. It was mainly the rise of strong states in early modern Europe that led to regular armies dominating war. In our world today, beset by absolute rises in population in the developing world where states are tenuous, especially in the bush and hinterland away from capital cities, various armed, non-state groups operate. These are people who feel they have to fight. To understand them, Van Creveld writes, the time has come to take leave of strategy, looking into the human soul instead. Just as it makes no sense to ask why people eat or what they sleep for, so fighting in many ways is not a means but an end. 41. Van Creveld's thesis of 1991 has been reified by the violence and political instability in Africa as local armies rampage in the hinterland. The May/June 2022 issue of Foreign Affairs featured a long report, Rebels Without a Cause, The New Face of African Warfare by Jason K. Stearns, who has lived and worked in Central Africa for many years. Stearns writes that armed conflicts in Africa are rarely about politics anymore. Those who take up arms these days are more likely to do so as a means of bargaining over resources. Government officials in Africa often seek to prolong and even instigate conflicts so long as they don't threaten regime survival. Violent African conflicts, he writes, have become more frequent and also more peripheral, that is, less central to politics. In the past decade, the number of armed groups in the Congo has doubled, to around 120. There are probably over 40 such groups in South Sudan, 20 in Libya, and at least several dozen in Nigeria. Instead of toppling regimes, these groups bargain with them through violence. Africa has entered an age of grinding low-level conflict and instability. In other words, fighting has become a way of life in significant parts of our world, just as Van Creveld prophesied. I say significant parts of our world because as the world contracts into a Weimar-like situation, so-called remote parts of Africa in our increasingly interconnected world matter to us much more than they used to. We are all part of the same human family, as we know from disease, migration, and immigration, however uncomfortable some of us may be with that fact. For example, the American political system, judging by its ideological battles, has no good solution to the crisis of its southern border with Mexico. That crisis, at root, is about the failure of governance in a number of Central American countries, beset by gangs and anarchy, in turn aggravated by a changing climate, rising youth populations, and resource dilemmas. This is the American aspect of the global migration crisis. The carrying capacity of the Earth is being challenged in a way it never has before. It is only because the United States is otherwise bordered by oceans and sparsely populated, middle-class Canada to the north, so that only one of our borders is troublesome, that we don't notice this development as much as we should. Add to all of this the profusion of disease and viruses on this more crowded planet far beyond Central America, with its resource scarcities, dramatic weather-related events, and periodic energy shortages caused by complex supply chains and political conflict. Governance itself is becoming more challenging, not less so. Again, this is due to the very crowded, urbanized, and therefore complex planet we increasingly inhabit. The beast has only just begun to snarl, writes science journalist Peter Brannan, referring to the Earth. All of recorded human history at only a few thousand years, a mere eye blink in geologic time has played out in perhaps the most stable climate window of the past 650,000 years. We have been shielded from the climate's violence by our short civilizational memory, and our remarkably good fortune, he goes on. But humanity's ongoing chemistry experiment on our planet could push the climate well beyond those slim historical parameters, into a state it hasn't seen in tens of millions of years, a world for which Homo sapiens did not evolve. 47. Brannan has given us the bottom line in regard to climate change, compressing the fear of helplessness on a planet, on which we are injecting CO2 into the air 10 times faster than even during the most extreme periods within the age of mammals, as he explains. 8. We are all in this together, in other words, as our loyalties slowly, imperceptibly shift from national to planetary, making my Weimar analogy, which deals only with political vacuums and disorganization, quaint even, as the issues we face go far beyond politics. Brannan's point about how we are injecting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at record levels is indirectly linked to the issue of population, since the more people there are, the more pollution is generated. While the world population is aging and population growth is slowing down in relative terms, something that will become more rapid in a generation or two, we are still adding more human beings to the planet at near record levels. There have never been this many human beings on the planet, and each year for several decades we'll see even more before the human population is projected to level off and decline. This has enormous implications in terms of environmental sustainability and governance in general, since the more people, the more subjects or citizens or constituents there are to govern, the harder it is to rule territory, making many of the problems I've mentioned thus far in this book that much more difficult. The more people, the less geography for each of them, and therefore the more that geography shrinks, giving us Weimar. A Weimar world is also a Malthusian world. There is no philosopher as reviled among the educated elite of both the left and right than Thomas Robert Malthus, whose essay published in 1798, On the Principle of Population, as it affects the future improvement of society, is considered the epitome of pessimism and determinism. Malthus continues to be ridiculed for claiming that while population increases geometrically, food supplies increase only arithmetically, so that humankind risks eventual shortages and starvation. In fact, during his lifetime, Malthus revised his theory 6 times while upholding the central thesis, that populations expand to the limits imposed by the means of subsistence. But social theorists may be judged by the questions they stimulate rather than by those they answer. And even more so than Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, Malthus introduced the whole subject of ecosystems into contemporary political philosophy, thereby immeasurably enriching it. Humankind might be nobler than the apes, but we are still biological. Therefore, our politics, Malthus suggested, are affected both by the natural conditions and by the densities in which we inhabit the earth. If Malthus is wrong, then why is it necessary to prove him wrong again and again, every decade and every century? Perhaps because, at some fundamental level, relating to the degradation of our eaten-away natural environment, there is a gnawing fear that Malthus may just be right. 41 To be sure, even as we attempt to reduce our dependence on hydrocarbons, that will only mean digging up the earth for precious metals like copper, lithium, and cobalt, as big shovel replaces big oil. 50 Once again, the earth is finite. Whenever we discuss limits to growth and urbanization or saving a plant species or some such, we are following in the footsteps of Malthus. The travel writer Paul Theroux may not care or have an opinion about Malthus. Yet some of his descriptions of Africa can arguably be labeled Malthusian. The younger Theroux lived for more than 6 continuous years in Africa and he returned there often. Africa is full of fond personal memories for him. But he has seen the continent change and not always in a good way. In his final travel book on Africa, published in 2013, The Last Train to Zona Verde, he serves up one harrowing description after another. Theroux starts by noting that at the time he writes, 200 million people in sub-Saharan Africa lived in slums, the highest number of slum dwellers in the world, according to the United Nations. And slum is a rather misleading word for these futureless places, as I was to see of stupefying disorder. Referring to South Africa, he goes on, the majority live in the lower depths, not in picturesque hamlets or thatched huts on verdant hillsides. 3/4 of city-dwelling Africans live in the nastiest slums and squatter camps. Theroux travels north by bus and car from South Africa into Namibia and Angola, a world of roadblocks and mobs, of terrible roads or no roads at all. The conditions never let up. Angolans lived among garbage heaps, plastic bottles, soda cans, torn bags, broken chairs, dead dogs, rotting food, indefinable slop. This blight was not darkness, the demeaning African epithet, but a gleaming vacancy. Nothing is sadder than squalor in daylight. Each town as he travels north looks exactly the same. He asks himself, why go any farther? Theroux at this point is sad and demoralized, wanting so much to describe more hopeful scenes, yet committed to vividly depicting the truth before his eyes. My feeling has always been that the truth is prophetic, and if I write accurately about the present, seeing things as they are, aspects of the future will be suggested. 51. Years before Jason Stearns published his report in Foreign Affairs, Theroux, who had just logged some 1,500 miles on land, reports that many of Africa's hinterlands have been controlled by heavily armed warlords and the like. 52 Africa, including its far-flung tracts, forms a significant part of our highly connected planet, where anarchy, as Financial Times columnist Janan Ganesh writes, is more of a likelihood than tyranny. Indeed, while journalists obsess about dictators and strongmen, it is the very lack of governance that could pose the greater risk, and not only in the developing world, but in the West, too. This very steep institutional decline, an abyss actually, in significant parts of the world brings me to the February 1994 issue of The Atlantic, in which I published a decidedly un-American cover story, un-American in that it was pessimistic and deterministic and, most importantly, declared that the victory of the United States in the recently concluded Cold War would be not so much short-lived as irrelevant, because of various natural, demographic, and cultural forces underway in the world. That would overwhelm America's classically liberal vision. It eschewed the debate over ideals that have traditionally been the fare of intellectual journals and newspaper opinion pages. Moreover, because of the unrestrained optimism of the era, globalization in the 1990s was being employed as a freshly conceived and positive buzzword. The pessimism of my essay was deeply alienating, if not abhorrent, to many. The title that the editors chose said it all: The Coming Anarchy, How scarcity, crime, overpopulation, tribalism, and disease are destroying the social fabric of the planet. My aim was to expose the illusion of knowledge where little actually existed among elites. At fancy conferences and in the major media of the era, people spoke breezily about how democracy would soon be overtaking the world, without knowing firsthand what the world they were talking about was really like, especially in developing countries beyond the luxury hotels, government ministries, and protected residential enclaves. To counter this trend, I visited the slums of cities in West Africa and Turkey, two radically different parts of the world, comparing the culture of poverty in the two regions, and drawing conclusions. What I said was provocative, or at least deemed to be by complacent champions of globalization. I claimed that in an increasingly claustrophobic world made smaller by technology and the spread of disease, the most obscure places in Africa could eventually become central to the future of the West, that Africa, rather than be placed on a protective pedestal and treated exclusively on its own terms, should be legitimately compared in vivid developmental detail to other parts of the world of which it formed a vital element. Africa was not marginal in my eyes, in other words. As for Turkey, its very abundance of water resources would make it a vital player in the 21st century, a time when, as I wrote in 1994, resource scarcity would play a major role in politics. Indeed, I emphasized how political and social interactions, including war, would be increasingly subject to the natural environment, which I labeled the national security issue of the 21st century. Whereas the opinion pages of the time, both liberal and conservative, were obsessed with the clashing ideas shaping the post-Cold War world, I concentrated on how the increasing lack of underground water and the increasing lack of nutrients in overused soils would, in indirect ways, inflame already existent ethnic, religious, and tribal divides. And this factor, merged with an ever-growing number of young males in the most economically and politically fragile societies, would amplify the chances of extremism and violent conflict. Natural forces were at work that would intensify political instability, if not necessarily everywhere, then certainly in the world's least governable parts. The most benighted parts of West Africa were a microcosm, albeit in exaggerated form, of turmoil to come around the globe. Africa certainly had something to teach us. Critics said that my bleak vision was demoralizing. But I was merely following the dictum of the late Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington, who said that the job of a scholar or observer is not necessarily to improve the world, but to say bluntly what he or she thought was actually going on in it. When it comes to making predictions, a journalist like myself cannot know the specific, short-term future, whether a country will have a coup or not within the next week. That depends on the Shakespearean dynamics between vital political actors and key intelligence that even the best spy agencies have difficulty uncovering, nor can a journalist or analyst know the situation of a country several decades hence, since so many factors, especially the advance of technology, make such a prediction mere speculation. But what a journalist or analyst can do is make the reader measurably less surprised by what happens in a given place over the middle-term future, 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years forward, say. And that is not an original idea. 10-year forecasts or thereabouts are the time frame utilized by many corporations in their planning exercises, as I know from my own work as a geopolitical consultant for Stratfor and Eurasia Group. It is a matter of catching a place during a moment in time. The coming anarchy began with a detailed description of Sierra Leone and Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, in mid-1993, with references to the general situation in West Africa during this period. This constituted roughly the first part of my lengthy essay, and it essentially painted the bleakest of possibilities for those places, which I basically described as countries that were so weakly governed that they were not really countries at all, but merely places with fictitious, meaningless borders on the map. Sierra Leone was in an extremely fragile political state when I visited there, and Côte d'Ivoire, though imperceptibly deteriorating, was then still seen in the West according to the cliché as an African success story. Articles in major world newspapers through the second half of the 1990s painted an optimistic picture for the prospects of these places as fledgling democracies. But my point in The Coming Anarchy, and a related Atlantic cover story titled Was Democracy Just a Moment, in the December 1997 issue, was that elections by themselves didn't matter nearly as much as the building of modern bureaucratic institutions. And West African countries, where populations would continue to grow dramatically in absolute terms for decades, had developed virtually none. That made me pessimistic. In 1999, half a decade after my essay was published, Sierra Leone descended into utter anarchy, with drug-crazed teenagers hacking the limbs off more than 1,000 civilians in the capital of Freetown alone and killing an additional several thousand, as armed groups mobs of young men more than disciplined soldiers terrorized the city. The number of refugees and displaced persons was well over 1 million, almost a quarter of the total population. UN peacekeeping troops would be forced to remain in Sierra Leone until 2005. During the same time frame, a coup rocked Côte d'Ivoire, and the country descended into a period of civil war and chaotic, geographically based political fractures lasting a decade until 2011. War in Liberia continued through 2003, and Nigeria never really arrested its decline as a coherent, centrally governed state. Over the past few years, Sierra Leone and Côte d'Ivoire have gradually gained a modicum of stability, even as political violence, tribalism, and crime continue to rear their heads. In 2013 to 2016, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea experienced a major Ebola outbreak. Of course, farther afield in the Middle East, the chaotic meltdowns of Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen following either American-led interventions or the rigors of the Arab Spring democracy movement indicated that beneath the carapaces of tyranny in those places lay complete institutional voids, comparable to what I had found in West Africa. Whereas what happened in Sierra Leone and Côte d'Ivoire was a consequence of the virtual absence of institutions and authority, the 1994 genocide in Rwanda was unconnected to Hobbesian chaos. With a tightly organized political and security apparatus, which perpetrated a crime with a distinctive modernist and systematized aura, Rwanda represented the evil possible under a strong state. Modernism, which implies a world of well-defined states and borders, has been especially cruel to both West Africa and the wider African interior, where ethnic, tribal, and linguistic boundaries crisscross and overlap, without the neat delineation so much beloved by Western statesmen since the Treaties of Westphalia, observes Gerard Prunier, a French scholar and expert on Africa. Here, he says, borders work best as porous membranes that are not set in the cast iron lines favored by Western imperialists. 54 The Coming Anarchy happened to describe West Africa at a moment when traditional culture was still being shredded by modernism and by modernism's false boundaries, but before new political and societal forms could take hold. The Coming Anarchy also focused on how elites would increasingly come to see the natural environment, especially water shortages and soil erosion in addition to shifts in the Earth's climate itself as a major foreign policy concern. This was far less obvious in 1994 than it is today. Moreover, I said that future wars would be motivated by communal survival, aggravated in some cases by environmental scarcity. The Middle East's diminishing water table would never be mentioned in reports of armed conflict there, but would operate as a silent and indirect factor nonetheless. As I concluded, an increasingly tightening world, beset by vast technological change, environmental scarcity, climate change, and absolute rises in population in the poorest countries simply cannot be at peace. 55. I concentrate on Africa here because while it is now 16% of the world population, it will rise to 26% of the world population by 2050 and will be almost 40% of the world population by 2100. At the turn of the 21st century, Europe and Africa had roughly the same population. At the end of the century, there could be 7 Africans for every European. While the fate of Europe seems today to lie in the East, in Ukraine, as the century progresses it will increasingly lie in the south, as steady migration from south of the Sahara takes hold. Propelled by rising expectations and climate change, people everywhere will be on the move, as it becomes increasingly obvious that we are all members of the same human family. Indeed, Africa is a microcosm of a world population that is expected to increase from 8 billion to 10.4 billion before the end of the century, despite the obvious graying of humanity, as populations especially in the developed world keep getting older. 75 to 90% of future urban growth around the world will occur in slums, many in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the United Nations. Think about it for a moment, a human population still growing by almost 20% before it levels off, affected by debilitating poverty in badly urbanized settings and intensifying climate change, and on the higher ends of the economic spectrum with border-defying cyber attacks on a scale we have not seen a distinct probability. Humankind on planet Earth will constitute an ever-tightening, closed system, divided against itself and armed to the teeth. The comparison with the Weimar Republic, alarming at first, may ultimately prove, once again, quaint. I will return to the social, historical, and technological forces roiling our planet in the last part of this book. First, I must describe the geopolitical situation that will face us for some years to come, as geopolitics is the principal surface element through which many of these historical forces play out.